Better.
Excellent. So, my name's Tom DeBrain. I heard Dr. DeBrain more than I've heard in a year. I'm a Dutch person. We're informal people. I call everyone by their first name, and I hope everyone does the same for me. If you feel the need to use titles, by all means, but please do call me Tom. And my wife, Megan, and that's how we do things. So I've come here this weekend to talk to you about the Messiah. And it was a tricky decision not to talk about the Messiah, but how to talk about the Messiah. Because as I struggled with how we're going to do this, I thought, where shall we start? Now, we just sung a song, a hymn, that starts from the Messiah, with a big capital M, meaning our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who we sung about. And that is one place to start with. It's not the place where you would start chronologically, because we assume that before that there was the Messiah, there was some kind of expectations about the Messiah throughout the Old Testament. I'm sure we've read one or two of these texts before. You may have heard one of these texts. And I thought, well, let's try to do it more chronologically. So this weekend, we're going to try to start in the very beginning, which is a very good place to start, and then move through time, and hopefully by Sunday, we'll made it to Jesus and the early Christian church. That all depends on how quickly I talk and how many questions we have. I understand that generally we save questions for the end. If you have a burning question that you just have no idea what I'm talking about, please don't wait till the end to say, I didn't understand what you said in minute two, because that's useless. But if you have a deep theological question about something where you speak like this with, that'll probably be best at the end. So the Messiah in the Old Testament. And that's a problematic text, a problematic idea. And I've got a quote here. I've got a couple of quotes, and mostly on the screen we'll be having Bible texts. But I have some learned quotes just to show you that I've done my homework. And this is Brother Collins, who works at Yale or Harvard, one of the two. I think it's Yale. He's an Irishman. He's a smart man. And he writes this in one of his books. Messianism has a more important place in the study of Christianity than in a comprehensive description of ancient Judaism. The Torah, rather than the Messiah, is central to traditional Judaism. And one might argue that Paul's rejection of the law precipitated the separation of Christianity from Judaism. Now, the bottom part of this quote is not as interesting for us as the top half, which is something fundamental about Judaism, at least very ancient Judaism. The Messiah is central for our faith, but it wasn't necessarily central for the Jewish faith. Now, I might be saying this, and suddenly you might be, your hairs start standing over end, because this might be world-shocking news, because we, as Christians, often seem to think that everyone has this messianic expectations that we do. And often in the Adventist church or in the Christian church, you'll hear, well, even the Muslims. I was talking to my parents last weekend, and one of my brothers-in-law is a Muslim. And they were saying that even the Muslims have this idea of the Messiah. So it's this big thing. But strangely enough, that's how we Christians experience it. But it's not so much the case for at least ancient Judaism. There are some hints, and it definitely grew, and today we're going to be tracing how this messianism grew, but it wasn't necessarily always the case that they were born with this idea, oh, there's going to be a Messiah. That wasn't the most fundamental part of Judaism at all. They had much more important things like the Torah and the temple, and, well, let's just stick with that. So John Collins, he writes this, and just a bit further down he writes, the traditional assumption, at least in Christian circles, has been that messianic expectation was ubiquitous, they love big words, the scholars, ubiquitous and had a consistent form. Consequently, the question of whether Jesus was the Messiah admitted a clear-cut answer. There has been a growing recognition in recent years that this view of the matter is heavily influenced by Christian theology. So what he's saying is, we Christians, our theology, where the Messiah is so central, has influenced how we look at Judaism, and we've made the Messiah more central than it may have been. That's what he's saying. And so we think that messianic expectations were ubiquitous. I can't define the word everywhere, I would say. Is that a good definition? Look, my wife is the English scholar here in the family. I'm the theologian. Anyway, ubiquitous is everywhere and consistent. So we imagine people woke up and they looked around as the Messiah being born. And like, oh no, we'll check again at midnight. But that's clearly not how Judaism worked, at least in the time, the ancient times or the time of Jesus. So when we look at this messianism, we're actually not going to see a whole lot of messianism in the Old Testament, which may be a bit strange for us. But we'll do it anyway and we'll see, and if you disagree with me, I'll hear in about 43 minutes. So messianism, what do we mean with messianism? I've got a definition. I don't think we really need to discuss it too much. The Messiah refers to a figure who will play an authoritative role in the end time, you know, dealing with sin in some way, usually an eschatological, that's a theological word for the end times, king. The Hebrew word, Messiah, Mashiach, just means anointed and doesn't necessarily mean eschatological figure at all. So when we look at the Messiah, we'll see many messiahs who are anointed, but they aren't really the Messiah. They're just a Messiah. See the difference between the two? Everyone got that? Right? Just the normal, like David was a Messiah because he was anointed, or any one of the priests would have been a Messiah because they were anointed. But they're not the Messiah. They're just a Messiah. Which gets a bit confusing, because if you look up the word Messiah, you'll find places where people are called Messiah, but they aren't necessarily the Messiah, like David or Aaron or whoever. So, when we look at messianism, the main thing we see is a king. And it's very natural that it would be a king, because if we think about ancient cultures, people had very specific ideas about a king. A king wasn't just some man who walked in from the street. A king had a link to the gods, right? In ancient Egypt, the king was very closely associated with the gods, or maybe even one of the gods. Even now in Japan, the emperor is almost a god, right? So there's always been this idea that kings are part of God. So it makes sense that if we're looking for someone who does things on behalf of God, the first place you'd look is a king. It also makes a whole lot of sense for us as Christians, because messiahs are kings. Jesus is the king. So it fits. Now, if we look at the king, the oldest place that we find a messianic king is here in Genesis. And I hope that everyone can read it. If you can't read it at the back, there are seats closer to me. I know that's a bit scary. We can also look them up in the Bible. This is from Genesis 49, which is the blessings of Jacob of his 12 sons plus his grandsons. And after a while, he gets to Judah. And he says, "Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's sons shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches down, he stretches out like a lioness, who dares raise him up?" There's a lot of metaphor poetry going on, but we've got this lion. We can see that he's above the other sons. It's kind of this royal imagery going on. And then it gets stronger in the next verses. "The scepter," who has a scepter, only kings have scepters, "the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And the obedience of the peoples is his. Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washes his garments in wine and his robe in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk." So we see a lot of kingly images in here, right? There's going to be this scepter that will never depart from Judah. So Judah's going to rule forever. He will have a ruler's staff with him forever. And then we have some generally bad ideas, like washing your clothes in wine. If I wash the suit in wine, probably not a great idea. Also, binding a foal to a vine is not a good idea because the donkey's going to eat the grapes, right? So apparently this king is so rich, he doesn't care what happens to these valuable things. He's going to ruin his clothing because, oh, I can wash it in wine. That's how rich I am. That's kind of the imagery that's going on here. So it's going to be a very powerful king. This is the oldest text where we see some kind of messianic expectation. Now, we have one interesting part here, one difficult thing, because until tribute comes to him. We don't actually know what the Hebrew means there. And if you look it up in a Bible, every Bible will have a different translation. I don't know what Bible you have there, but I see one open. What does yours say right there? Staff between his feet.
No, the little staff from between his feet.
And then?
Until Shiloh comes.
And if we look it up in, say, an NIV, we will read something, until he to whom it belongs comes. So there's this Hebrew here that's just very hard to understand. It doesn't make a whole lot of... We don't know who the Shiloh is who would come. Shiloh might mean tribute. It might also mean someone else is coming. And people often read this as until he comes, you know, the future king. But that was a later adaption that we'll see in a bit. So we can move on. Later on in Numbers, we run into a king as well. And this is in the story of Balaam. Is it Balaam in English with the donkey that talks? Balaam. I'm still learning the English names for a lot of the Bible people because Dutch. We call him Bileam in Dutch. Balaam. And Balaam has this vision in Numbers 24, and he says, I see him, but not now. Behold him, but not near. A star, right, like a star above Bethlehem, it's a kingly symbol. A star will come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and it will crush the borderlands of Moab and the terror of the Shethites, and Edom will become a possession, and Seir a possession, and Jacob's a rule, and destroy the survivors. So we have a number of royal images here. A star and a scepter. And the next time we have anything to do with a king, if we're running through the time, is when we actually have kings, with Saul and with David. So these are the only two passages that we can find in the Old Testament that predate the kings, that talk about kings. Judah, where it says, oh, Judah will be a ruler of his people, a ruler of his brothers, and Balaam, who says, I see the star and the scepter rising. And the next time we have anything about a king is Saul, and then, even better, David, when we have a real proper king. Now, this has confused people who study the Bible. Why do we only have these two, and can we trust these two? What do I mean with this? I don't know how critical you're used to thinking about the Bible, and I don't want to say we need to be critical of the Bible, but it's always good to be aware of what other people are saying. And what a lot of people are saying is, it seems like these two passages were actually, because most of the Bible was only written in the time of the kings when they were in Israel, these two prophecies were actually added later. So once Judah's descendant David became king, that's when they added this passage. So it's not actually a prophecy, it's what they call an ex eventu, it's after the event. There's no way of knowing what it is because we can't go back in time. Very critical people will say that. People who take the Bible less critically will say, well, no, this seems to be a prophecy. But of what exactly? Is this a prophecy about Jesus? About the Messiah who's coming? It doesn't seem like it. It seems to be more a prophecy just of David and David's sons and David's lineage, right? A star will come out of Jacob, a scepter will rise, he will crush the Moabites and the Edomites and the Shethites and the Seirites, and Israel will rule. That's not talking about the Savior of mankind. That's talking about the Israelite kingdom. This isn't a Messiah. We might want to interpret it as a Messiah as well, but primarily the first meaning of this text is just good old King David. And as we talk about good old King David, we run into good old King David. Because the next time, as we run through time in the Bible, that we run into any kind of prophecy about a king is the story of David and the temple. We can't read the whole passage because it's quite long. I hope you have some memory of this passage. It's in 2 Samuel 7. The story is David is living in his let's say, castle. Right? In Scotland, we have castles. He's living in his castle. He's got a good house. And he looks around and he thinks, I've got this castle and God is still in a tent. That's not good. So he says, you know what I should do? I should build God a house. So he calls his prophet Nathan and he says to Nathan, I want to build God a house. Nathan says, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And they both go home and David gets ready to build the house. That night Nathan has the vision and Nathan comes back to David and says, no, don't build the house because the Lord is kind of upset about that because the Lord says, who are you to build me a house? If I wanted a house, I'd build it myself. Right? If I want a tent, that's what I told my people, I'm happy in my tent. And then God says via Nathan, who are you to build me a house? I will build you a house. But he doesn't mean a physical house. He's talking about his lineage. And this is literally what he says in verse 12. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come forth from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. So this is Solomon. And he shall build a house. So you're not going to build a house for me. Your son will build a house. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Forever. That's a very important word there. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will punish him with a rod such as mortals use, with blows inflicted by human beings. But I will not take my steadfast love from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall be made forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. If you take a word away from this prophecy, it's probably going to be the word forever. How long is David's line going to last? Forever. How long are his children going to sit on the throne? Forever. Now that gets a bit problematic when there's no longer a son of David on the throne. And if we follow history on, we get to a point in time where Jerusalem has fallen, where the Babylonians have come in, Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel, we hopefully know the story as well, comes in and has taken over Jerusalem and has taken the people into exile. And then what happens? How do you deal with that? If the Lord has promised you, your son will be on this throne forever, and we look at the throne and there's not a son on it, what's going on? What's going on in your mind? In the academic theologians will say this is a cognitive dissonance, because they like difficult words, I think. In our mind, what we think is not matching with what we see. We know that there's always going to be a Davidic king on the throne, but if we look at the throne, there's not a Davidic king there. So there's a dissonance. It's not connected. It's not the same. And when you see that, suddenly you have to start thinking, what does this mean? How do we deal with this? Well, there's a number of options. One, God is a liar. It's probably not the option that most people would choose. At least I wouldn't, and I don't think many of the Israelites would. Option two is you're misunderstanding what is being said. So either the promise is a lie, that's probably not the case. We're misunderstanding the promise. And that seems to be what went on with the Israelites as they lived in exile. They knew there was going to be a king forever, but that king was not there, so they started to think, well, this must be some kind of metaphor, must be metaphorical. So it's not going to be a king forever, but there will come a time when the king comes back, and that time will probably be forever. And thus we see that some sort of messianism is born. This promise that David will always have a son on the throne, and there is no son on the throne, forces them to start to interpret it as a prophecy about the far future. There will be a day when there is a Davidic king on the throne again. And on that day, we will see the true Messiah, we'll see the true plan of God. And this seems to be what's going on with the Israelites as they live in the Babylonian captivity. Now we run into a number of passages about, I've just lost where I am, sorry, about the where we see this change of tone in later prophets. For example, in Amos, on that day I will raise up the booth of David that has fallen. Right? Well, it's a bit strange to call it a booth because kings don't have a booth, but this made sense to them. The booth of David has fallen, and repair its branches, and raise up its ruins, and rebuild it as in the days of old, in order that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the nations who are called by my name, says the Lord who does this. So we see here that suddenly this prophecy that was just saying to David, well, your children are going to rule, has now become, oh wait, the children aren't going to rule, but there will be a day when God will raise up. And it's become this expectation. And we see this the whole time. This is a very famous verse because we know it from Matthew 2 or 3. But you, O Bethlehem of who can help me pronounce that in it? Ephrathah. Why is that TH not a th? Ephrathah. O Bethlehem of Ephratah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from old, from ancient days. Now Bethlehem is where David was from, but this was written after David by Micah. So he's saying there will come another king, and we all think, oh yes, that's Jesus, because that's what we used to, but this is the first time they're putting these words on paper. They're seeing that we should have a David, we don't have a David, there will be a new David. A new Messiah coming, a new king. And Micah 5 continues, therefore this king from Bethlehem, therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has brought forth, and the rest of his kingdom shall return to the people of Israel. So everyone is going to join. The Gentiles and the Israelites are joining to Israel. He shall stand up and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord and the majesty of the name of the God. Lord is God, and they shall live secure, and for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. So it's not just a little Israelite kingdom, it's the ends of the earth, it's the whole world under this man. And he shall be the one of our peace, and if the Assyrians come into our land and tread upon their soil, he will raise up against them 7 shepherds and 8 installed as rulers. So we see this totally new kind of way of thinking about that one promise to David, where it has become universal. And not only universal as in worldwide, but universal as in including all people, and they all will be brought together, and they all will be ruled. And we see it again in Isaiah. A shoot shall come out of the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of its roots. And we see it again in Jeremiah. The days are surely coming when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely, and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. And in his days Judah will be saved, and Israel will live in safety. And this is the name by which he shall be called, the Lord is our righteousness. So there's this very clear new expectation of a Messiah. Now, maybe at this time, a number of you, and I don't know if anyone knows when all these people were writing, a number of you are thinking, well, it seems like a lot of the people Tom is quoting are actually before the exile. Don't know if anyone thought that. Then I don't have to explain how it is. No, some of these people are written before the exile, but we have strong reasons to believe that these words were added during the exile. The reason being, it's very hard to talk about the exile before the exile and say, David's booth has fallen before it's actually happened. It seems much more likely that that one was added during the editing process later. And we know that books were edited for Jeremiah wrote his book, but some people edited afterwards, because we see that all over the Bible. Up until this day, this place is still called La La La. That wouldn't make any sense if Moses had written that down. It only made sense centuries later. So there's always been a few editorial adjustments to help us understand things. So we have this whole collection of changes where we see that a very simple prophecy to David, because of the reality of the world, has become a messianic expectation. Does that go against God's plan? No, clearly not. The Lord leads the people as they go through time, and we keep learning more and more about him. But the circumstances that the people were in helped them understand, as I understand at least, helped them understand God's plan better. They first saw the promise to David, just as there will always be a Davidic king. But once the kingdom had fallen, they were forced to learn the deeper and more difficult meaning. And that seems to be what's going on. Now, we can actually trace this theme a bit further with something called the Septuagint. And the Septuagint is a lot more interesting for me because the Septuagint is the Old Testament translated into Greek. When did this happen? Probably about 200, 300 before Christ. And what was the story? A lot of Jews lived around the world. Not many of them still spoke Hebrew, so they needed a Bible in their own language. So people got together and translated it into their own language, which was Greek. Just like we prefer our English Bibles to our Greek Bibles, they preferred their Greek Bibles to their Hebrew Bibles because Greek was what they spoke at home. But because the Septuagint was translated so late, 300 before Christ, we can actually see how they are understanding the texts because they translate them with a bit of creativity. Let's put it that way. So one of the passages we just read, I found it in, I've given you the translation. This is Genesis 49, the first passage we read about Judah with that difficult to understand Hebrew bit. In Greek, it's very easy to understand. It says, until the one laid away may come to him, he is the expectation of nations. So until Shiloh comes, whatever that means, has now become a very clear expectation of a soon coming Messiah, who is not only the expectation of Israel, but the expectation of the nations, of the Gentiles. And we see this elsewhere. For example, if we look up the passage, the first passage we read in Numbers, the word scepter is suddenly translated as a man. So it's no longer just this king, but it seems to be that they're filling in these things. And then we get random things. Oh, this says it's Numbers, but it's not. It's Isaiah somewhere. This is what our Bible says. For lo, the one who forms the mountains, creates the wind, reveals his thoughts to mortals, and makes the morning darkness, and treads on the heights of the earth. The Lord, the God of hosts, is his name. But if we look it up in the Greek translation, his thoughts is now the Messiah, Christos, Christ. For lo, the one who forms the mountains, creates the wind, and reveals the Messiah to mortals. Now the Hebrew for thoughts and Messiah are similar. They both have an M and an S in it. But when they translated, apparently they had a bit of creativity and they thought, well, this is a good place for the Messiah to be added, because they were expecting this Messiah. The Messiah was meant to be there in the 2nd, 3rd century, and they saw it in places that may not originally have been. So when we trace this, what we're kind of seeing is that in the very beginning, there are some prophecies about a king, but that's just about good old King David. Then to King David, we have this prophecy about having a house forever. But when that house falls, that prophecy needs to be reinterpreted. And that prophecy becomes no longer just a normal, oh, David's going to have a long lineage, but it becomes an expectation of a universal Messiah, a universal king. Now, this is one of the big forms of messianism throughout the Old Testament. The most important one, it's the one that comes back most. And if we look at the New Testament, whenever they talk about Jesus' lineage, they always link him back to King David. Right? And they say this is, what is Matthew 1? This is the birth list of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Right? That David keeps coming back because that king bit is very, very important. But as good Adventists, we know that Jesus is more than just a king. I hope we know that. We have a fundamental about it where we talk about Jesus and his priestly ministry, right? Where Jesus is a priest as well. And if we look at the New Testament, there seems to be also some kind of expectations about there being this religious Messiah, not just a kingly Messiah, but a religious Messiah. And the best way to see this, I think, is to see it's some kind of expectation of a prophet or a priest. What is the difference? Well, it's a bit hard to see the difference sometimes. Sometimes the word helps us, but it's a religious Messiah rather than a civil Messiah. And you have to look really, really hard to find any expectations of a religious Messiah in the Old Testament. I think I could only find three or four. The first one, and maybe the most famous one, is from Deuteronomy 18. This is not a very famous text because not many people read Deuteronomy for fun. I don't, at least. But Deuteronomy 18 is where Moses is giving the law, and he gives the law for quite a long time. And in 18, he's discussing about what to do with witchcraft and soothsayers and looking at the birds to divine the future and all that kind of stuff. And he's saying, don't do that. Not a big surprise so far, right? And then he says, and the solution for this is this. Don't do soothsayers, because the Lord your God will rise up for you a prophet like me, like Moses from among your people. You shall heed such a prophet. This is what you requested of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, if I hear the voice of the Lord my God anymore, or ever again see this great fire, I shall die. Then the Lord replied to me, they are right in what they have said. I will rise up for them a prophet like you from among their own people. So Moses is saying back when we got the law in the Sinai, Exodus 20, we were worried about this, and the Lord promised that there will be a prophet. And I will put my words in the mouth of this prophet, who shall speak to them everything I command. Anyone who does not heed the words that the prophet shall speak in my name, I myself will hold accountable. But any prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, who presumes to speak in my name a word that I have not commanded the prophet to speak, that prophet shall die. You may say to yourself, how can we recognize a word that the Lord has spoken? If a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, but the thing does not take place or prove true, it is a word that the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. Do not be frightened by it. So this is the oldest passage where we see some kind of expectation of a religious figure. Now, this is a very difficult to understand passage because it's talking about a prophet. And in fact, in some Bibles, it doesn't say a prophet, but it says a prophet with a capital P, meaning the prophet. And it's hard to understand exactly what's going on here, because if we're talking about don't listen to witches who tell you the future, because in 3 million years a prophet will be born, the solution doesn't solve the problem. Right? Do you see what I mean? No one's nodding, but you see what I mean. If the Lord is saying to them, oh, you can't trust these false prophets because you will get a prophet in 2,000 years, that's not going to solve the problem. What solves the problem is having a constant list of prophets like we do throughout the Old Testament. So it seems like even though the word a prophet is used, it's actually referring to the function of prophet throughout the Old Testament, the list of prophets, every one of them, because every one of them counteracts these false prophets, these witches, these soothsayers, these diviners. And actually, in a lot of modern translations, this is now being translated as prophets instead of prophet, which leads to a whole lot of trouble with people who read the Bible, because then they say, oh, you're taking Jesus out of the Old Testament, which is not the case. We're just trying to make sense of this difficult to understand passage. So does this talk about a prophet that will come? Is this a reference to, say, John the Baptist or Jesus? Well, yes, but it's also probably a reference to Elijah and Elisha and Nathan and all the other prophets that came along that led people to Jesus. The other expectation we see for a religious person is specifically for one of them, Elijah. Lo, I will send you the prophet, this is from Malachi, send you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of parents to their children and the hearts of children to their parents, so that I will not come and strike the land with a curse. Now, if generally at Jewish activities, you'll see one chair is kept free for the prophet Elijah. At circumcisions, etc., they often keep one chair free, not for fashionably late guests, but for Elijah, who they're still expecting. And that is based mainly from this and a few other texts like this. Does this refer to Jesus Christ, the Messiah? Not really, let's say that. So we have these hints, but not a very strong expectation of a coming priest who will come and refine things. Until we get something which is really, really makes a lot of sense for us in retrospect, but at the time it must have been quite confusing. And that is that some passages actually talk of two messiahs. We often think there's one messiah, right? Jesus Christ. But there are some passages that seem to imply that there are two, and it's not actually seem to imply, it's quite clear. For example, in Zechariah's fifth vision, then he said, there are two anointed ones, two messiahs, who shall stand by the Lord of the whole earth. It's a bit strange, because if Jesus is the one, who's the other? So maybe this isn't the actual Messiah, but just a Messiah. That would make more sense. But if we look at Psalm 110, which is quite a famous psalm, and is in fact the psalm that is quoted most in the New Testament, fun fact, Bible verse that is quoted most in the New Testament, Psalm 101, you can use those on one of those Friday night Bible ball questions. This is the answer. There it says, The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord sends out from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your foes. Your people will offer themselves willingly on the day you lead your forces on the holy mountains. From the womb of the morning like dew, your youth will come. So, for me, this doesn't seem to be very messianic so far. A lot of people see that it's talking about a king. The mighty scepter rule in the midst of your role. So there's these ideas of a king, but it doesn't seem to necessarily talk about the future as such. But then it continues and it says, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, which is something that gets quoted in Hebrews 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times when we're talking about Jesus as high priest. The Lord is at your right hand. So you're not at the right hand of the Lord, but the Lord is at your right hand, which is interesting imagery. And the Lord will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations. So we're talking about the end of time here, filling them with corpses, and he will shatter heads over the whole wide earth. He will drink from the stream by the path. Therefore, he will lift up his head. So, here this is clearly talking about a priest, right? You are a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And when is he talking about this? During the judgment, at the end of time. So here we have a very, very clear expectation, and this is the only one, of a priest coming in the future. In addition to a king, as a king, we Christians will immediately say, priest and king, they fit together. Was that what was going through whoever wrote Psalm 110? It doesn't say it's a Psalm of David at the top, so we don't really know who wrote it. Is that what was going through the author's mind? That's kind of harder to say. So we've kind of, this was our introduction, and in quite a fast pace, we've been through the Old Testament. And we've tried to run through the passages in chronological order. And we've made it all the way up to, let's say, 3rd century before Christ in 50 minutes. It's pretty good, seeing as it's about 4,000 years of history. And we've tried to trace this Messiah, and I've tried to write a couple of conclusions at the end. I think, and if you disagree with me, I'd love that, but I think the first thing I said was that Messianism doesn't seem to play a very large role in ancient Judaism. It's not as fundamental to their faith as it is to ours. They could live without the Messiah. We could not. We could live without the Torah, at least most of it. They could not. Right? So they're different religions. There are a number of messianic prophecies before the exile, that one in Judah and that one in Numbers of Balaam. And these may be what people call royal propaganda, so they were added by the kings of David, or if they're not, which I would say is more likely, they refer to the Davidic kings. So they're not messianic, they're just prophecy. And then what we see is it seems that messianism develops after or during the exile due to what we call cognitive dissonance, so that what you think should happen does not reflect reality. Because the promises and reality, they don't match up. There should be a king forever, but the king is not there. And when that happens, suddenly you have to reinterpret your world. And as the Jews are reinterpreting their world, they're interpreting these things not as referring to just David, but to a forever and universal king. And there seems to be what we would call pluralism with the expectation. So it's not just one clear-cut expectation of a king, but there's also maybe this bit of a prophet, and there's definitely this priest who's like Melchizedek, whatever that may mean, who is coming as well. And that seems to be, for me, a good summary of messianism in the Old Testament, which I would imagine is very different to what we generally think about messianism in the Old Testament. Because if we think about messianism in the Old Testament, we often think about the prophecies, and this happened so that it would be fulfilled, what was written in the prophet Isaiah, and then it quotes Isaiah, as we have in the Gospels. But that seems to be later understanding that helps us understand the Old Testament that wasn't necessarily something that the Jews understood then. If that makes sense. So tomorrow, my plan is to continue through time, not to the New Testament yet, but to talk about the gap, the intertestamental times, see what, that's tomorrow night, tomorrow evening, see what people started to think there, how messianism developed, what happened in history, because the way that history developed at the time, which we generally don't know as much about in the church, actually strongly influences messianism, so that we can understand what people were thinking when they met Jesus and what they were expecting when Jesus came to the temple and the prophet Anna was there and she was waiting for the consolation of Israel, whatever the consolation of Israel may mean. So hopefully we're getting there, that by Sunday morning we'll be able to tackle some of the harder New Testament passages and figure out what all that means.